And he can, because you can go against the rules. And if you know what they are, it's easier to break them.
Hello and welcome to this Short Fiction Masterclass, brought to you by Thresholds, the International Short Story Forum, in collaboration with the Charleston Trust. My name is Jack Catania, and I'll be talking to the novelist and short story writer Sally Vickers about her collection, The Boy Who Could See Death. Today we are going to explore anarchy, maternal betrayal, landscapes of light and darkness, and tapping into unlived lives. This is the beginning of the train that left when it was not supposed to.
The first sign that something was amiss was the train that left when it was not supposed to. The would-be passengers were standing variously eager, impatient, bored, or resentful beneath the illuminated departures notice at King's Cross. Quite clearly, the sign for the train to York read 11:25 on time. No notice was given of the platform number. And then, at 11:12, precisely, with no further notice, the board in rapid succession read, "Now boarding," and then almost immediately, "Train departed." Two other odd things happened that day. The visitors to Stonehenge, who had queued patiently to see the ancient stone circle, were attacked by a swarm of apparently violently angry bees, and several people with allergic reactions to the stings were hospitalised. And there was more than one report of a creature resembling a wolf sighted in Windsor Great Park. "But there have been no wolves in England since Tudor times," Nan Maitland observed as her husband turned off the TV. "Well, it's sheer nonsense, of course." Matthew Maitland was a scientist. He loved his wife, but had never come to terms with her readiness to be beguiled by the weird or the strange. "Do you think it escaped from a zoo? If it exists." Her husband had already left her realm of speculation and was reabsorbed in a paper he was refereeing for Nature concerning the ethics of animal experimentation. Nan was an artist. When she met Matt, she was working as a waitress in a modest restaurant, more of a glamorized snack bar, really, near the Medical Research Council, where Matt held a position at the time. He had taken the then Minister for Science and Education to the restaurant in order, as he later confided to Nan, to take the arsehole down a peg. Nan had spilled water on the arsehole's trousers, causing embarrassment to the minister and mirth to Matt, who had left so large a tip that she had thanked him the next time he came to the restaurant to eat alone. He had asked her out to eat in a definitely superior restaurant near his flat in Camden Town, and, at the end of the evening, asked if she would like to come back to his place for coffee. It was maybe the only time they had really understood each other.
"Thank you. I love that line. It was maybe the only time that they really understood each other." Your opening encompasses humour and a sense of the uncanny, and a very strong sense of place, but also the profound misunderstandings that underlie human relationships.
Yeah, well, that's something I'm interested in.
Yes, clearly. And you've said that the story was inspired by Windsor Great Park. You've been quoted as saying, "The anarchy that is in Falstaff's blood seems to get into the veins of this story." That's a quote which references The Merry Wives of Windsor, which is set in Windsor Great Park. And I was wondering if you could tell us about the relationship between anarchy and structure in the short story form, because there's anarchy in this story, isn't there?
I think of all the stories, it's the most anarchic. It's a story that... One of the things about writing a short story as opposed to a novel, and I'm primarily so far a novelist, is that a short story allows a degree of experimentation in form and structure. My novels, I am told, are quite carefully structured. I don't actually structure them, they structure themselves. But I think there's an opportunity to put a kind of riff in a short story. And I think in this collection there are a lot of different structural tones, experimentations.
Yes.
I love Shakespeare. I find Falstaff a very significant and important character within the Shakespeare canon. I love the Verdi opera Falstaff. Mm. And I think I quote my old lecturer at university, Elsie Knight, saying that there were various things that made him laugh whenever he thought about them, and one of them was Falstaff crammed into the laundry basket in The Merry Wives of Windsor. Mm-hmm. And he used to go on and say, you know, crammed with all the women's underwear, no doubt.
Yes.
So I think that somehow the mixture between Shakespeare and Falstaff, Windsor Great Park, which is a very old park and is preserved in its very ancient form, with the exception of the things like the road through it, and the opportunity of misunderstanding between men and women somehow
yes.
informs that particular story.
And the next line in the story is actually, all good marriages are not always based on mutual understanding. The revelation of the blind spots and the betrayal of marriages kind of runs as a theme through many of your stories, for example, Rescue, Mown Grass, and most savagely, Vacation.
I think Vacation is the savagest story I have ever written. It's very savage. I don't quite know why or what it's about. But you see, again, as I was saying earlier, the thing about a short story, it does give you this opportunity for different structures, but also different voices.
Yes.
So the kind of voice that I tend to adopt in the novels, which is not uniform, but there is, I suppose, an overall statistical consistency in which there's a play between light and dark, and there's a play between tragedy and comedy, which is very much my feeling about life, that life is not one or the other. And I like that kind of mix, and the ways in which comedy is very close to tragedy, tragedy very close to comedy. But I'm not usually savage, and I think Vacation is quite a savage story.
It is a savage story.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I think that, I mean, some people find it very uncomfortable. I suppose they just have to kind of take their lot. I think there are plenty of stories that are quite comfortable in this collection.
Mm.
Kleptomania, for example, A Christmas Gift, they're both quite positive and warm-hearted stories. The Churchyard, although it has a sad undertow, has a resolution at the end, as indeed does A Sad Tale, which has a very sad undertow but has a resolution at the end. But Vacation, I think, is a difficult one. And all I can say is it was a good opportunity for me to try out a savage part of my writing voice.
And I think it'd be worth mentioning that the underlying relationships that are explored in this story, which is the main character, Hamish, seems to be doomed by his childhood trauma to repeat betrayals upon betrayals. So he betrays his wife, but is subsequently betrayed by his mother in quite a shocking way.
He's finally betrayed by his mother in a very shocking way. I think she may be the most sinister character I've ever written about.
And you've said that, as a psychoanalyst, maternal betrayal is not a novel idea to me. Can you tell us a bit more about how your training and practice as a psychoanalyst informs your characters, your insight into your characters?
Yes, I think it undoubtedly does. It would be odd if it didn't, wouldn't it? My first job was actually as a lecturer and teacher in English literature, which I think was invaluable because, as I say, when I teach creative writing, which I do rather rarely, I can't really teach you anything about writing, but I can encourage you and possibly help you to read deeply. And I think the deep reading that I was obliged to do, both as an undergraduate but more importantly as a teacher of literature, was incredibly useful. Not just about the writing and the prose style and the structure, but I think the psychology, because I think the great novelists and the great story writers like Catherine Mansfield are supreme psychologists, far, far superior to Freud or Jung or even the best of the great psychologists. But I think the important thing about practicing as a psychoanalyst was, obviously, the opportunity to discover firsthand the kinds of ways in which people experienced betrayal by their parents, betrayal by their mother, their father, their siblings, their schooling, society. It isn't just the parents. I think betrayal of expectation, betrayal of need, betrayal of want is a very common theme in psychoanalysis.
Yes.
But I think what I really learnt from psychoanalysis in terms of writing is to, when I at least communed with somebody who was coming to see me in my capacity as a psychoanalyst, I would try to find the language with which I could best communicate with them. In other words, I would try to find the part of myself that was not necessarily a part I'd experienced or lived in life. Very often it was an unconscious part that in some way replicated or spoke to the person I was communing with. Which meant, for example, to take a very simple example, if I was in dialogue with a man, I would try to find the masculine part of myself.
I see.
The better to be understood, but also the better for that person to feel understood by me.
Yes.
And I think that that training in finding aspects of my own being that may have been unlived, but I could find through the process of talking to very different people, was an invaluable training for the creation of characters, or the bringing out of myself characters. So I think that was the most important thing I learned from working as a psychoanalyst. Certainly things like maternal betrayal was another thing. But I think the ability to find parts of oneself that are not one's lived self is the most important bit.
Part of fiction writing. That's fascinating, and it rings really true, I think, with your characters, because some of them are victims and some of them are very conscious in their actions. Mm. Hamish's mother is very conscious in her betrayal of Hamish. She's deliberately manipulating the situation.
She's unusually conscious. Yes. I think that's what makes her a monster.
Yes, that's what creates this character that we don't sympathise with. Mm. Though there is a certain amount of relish in the discomfort that she causes Hamish in the reader as well, which makes the reader complicit somehow in what she does.
Yes, and I think the other thing about that particular relationship is Beth, the wife, who has always disliked the mother, finds through the mother a means of getting back at her husband. So, I mean, the serious betrayal is from the mother, the betrayal of the mother of her son. But Beth, who has been betrayed by her son, who is her husband, through the mother, finds a means of betraying him. And I think that
of revenge.
Yeah, it's revenge, but I think it's a particular kind of revenge. It's a very subtle revenge. And that is quite interesting because I think something happens. When people become victims, one of the first things that happens is there's a kind of ganging up. And to have the ganging up between your wife and your mother, particularly when the mother has been a source of extreme animosity in the past to the wife, I think is a particularly unpleasant betrayal.
Yes. So. That's really interesting, and it's great to have that sort of sense of knowledge behind human relationships that you bring. There are moments when people just have that strong sense of recognition.
One of the great things about having an expertise in any area for a writer is that you can go against the conventions with it. You can play around with it. Mm. One of my own favourite books written by me is The Other Side of You. The narrator is a psychoanalyst. He's a psychiatrist, which I never was, and a psychoanalyst. He's a man, and he isn't me. Nothing in his life experience is me, except I have done this job.
Yes.
And I have worked with people who have attempted suicide, which is his particular area of expertise. And he does something in the course of his therapeutic relationship with a particular patient who is really the heroine of the story, which goes against all the rules. And psychotherapists write to me and say, but you know, he can't do that, it's against the rules. And I say, yeah, but he does.
Yes.
And he can, because you can go against the rules. And if you know what they are, it's easier to break them. So I don't feel any problem about going outside the established conventions of psychology or psychoanalysis. Mm. And nor do I feel the need to explain things, because I suppose I've done it for so long and I know it so well. I'm hoping it comes through without explanation.
I think it does. I think it does. And I think the short story form actually allows that moment of revelation for your characters, but also the moment of revelation for the reader. to really be quite powerful, even if subtle and understated. Mm. So, for example, it can be quite comic in Kleptomania, where a family spends a lot of time looking for a silver fox that they believe one of their friends has stolen from a rented property where they've been staying, and actually the landlady has sold it. And so they spend a lot of time, a lot of energy, and in fact a lot of money.
Replacing the silver fox with the silver fox.
With the silver fox. Their realisation of what they've done and the time wasted is comic. But sometimes the revelation, as in Hamish's case, when he realises what is happening in his life, when he realises the relationship between his mother and his wife, is quite horrible for him, but also for the reader.
I think so.
And I was wondering if you felt that leaving the reader in that kind of discomfort, which happens in a short story because there's, as you say, less resolution than in a novel, are you content to leave the reader feeling discomforted?
Well, I suppose I must be, or I wouldn't do it. It's something I'm less willing to do in a novel. I suppose I feel that the investment in a short story, although it can be quite deep for the reader, and I would hope it might be, I think it's not such a long-term investment.
Mm.
And I don't think it does any harm to be a bit shocked. If I did it all the time, I wouldn't particularly think that was very interesting. Mm. But to do it when I very often don't do it, I think is different.
Yes, it is. It gives part of the story.
I think one of the interesting things for me about Kleptomania, which I didn't intend but realised once I'd finished it, is that the true kleptomania is not the kleptomania of Cousin Francesca, who is supposed to be a kleptomaniac, but actually takes nothing. It's Peter, because he steals the time.
Yes.
From the holiday.
Yes.
So it's a kind of comment on the way in which people can not exactly catch psychological conditions, but in their anxiety about other people's potential to disrupt their lives,
yes,
they become themselves the disruptors.
Yes.
So, I mean, that was for me the humorous element.
Yes.
But also the sort of slightly psychological element.
Yes. I can really see that in the story, that sense of discomfort that is created when it didn't need to be. It didn't need to be there. And I think you also create discomfort through a completely different means, which is a kind of supernatural element, which comes into many of these stories. It's a supernatural element, but it's a fundamental interest in the interplay between life and death. And several of the stories, like The Churchyard, reflect this. And I wondered if you would read us the beginning of the title story, The Boy Who Could See Death.
Eli was not quite 7 years old when he discovered that he was different, but perhaps different was not at the time, at least, the right word, for at the time, in most ways, he was a quite ordinary child, with the common traits, good and bad, and many in between, that ordinary little boys will have. But, in one important respect, he differed from the ordinary. Eli discovered this when, one March day, he looked into the eyes of his friend Thomas Wilkes and said, "You are going to die on Tuesday." This pronouncement, delivered with unusual solemnity, naturally upset Tommy Wilkes, who was found by his mother in the garden, crying and saying goodbye to his treehouse. She had words with Eli's mother, Mrs. Faring, who took the complaint calmly. "I'm sorry if Tommy was upset, but boys will be boys. I'm sure it was just Eli's silly joke." But when Eli's mother spoke to her son about the matter, he looked at her in bewilderment. "But he is going to die," he said. "He'll hit his head." "I've told you not to be fanciful," said his mother sharply, but in truth she was a little disconcerted. She spoke to Eli's father when he came home from work. "Boys fooling around," was his father's verdict. He was tired and wanted his regular evening beer and to be left in peace to watch the news. But when the following Tuesday after school Tommy Wilkes fell from his treehouse and broke his neck, it was inevitable that questions were asked. And it was just as inevitable that the distraught family of the dead boy should feel obliquely that Eli was somehow to blame. Although he had been nowhere near either Thomas or the treehouse when the accident occurred, It was suspected by the grieving family that the strange prediction must somehow have precipitated the tragedy. Eli's parents questioned him themselves about the incident, but all Eli would say was, "I saw it in his eyes." Pressing him to expand on this proved useless. Eli had nothing to add.
Thank you. Could you tell us a little bit about how that story came to be? What was it inspired by?
Well, you know, I don't really know. One day, I was staying at a friend's house. They had gone off to church, as it happens. I didn't go. I wasn't feeling very well. I had a cold coming on and a sore throat, and I was just hanging around their house, not really doing very much, and somehow, suddenly, this child popped into my head. And I knew what he was called. I very often know the names of characters immediately. I mean, almost always with a, I think always with a principal character, I will know their name before I know anything else. And I knew he was called Eli. And I knew that to be able to see and foresee a person's death was going to shadow his life.
Yes.
That it was going to be a blight and not a blessing. And I just let him take me. I just let the story unfold. I didn't know what would happen to him. I didn't know where he'd go. I didn't know who he'd meet. I just literally followed him. And the ending was very, very strange because I didn't really have any idea what was going on myself as I wrote it.
Mm. Because it's almost transcendent, isn't it? Eli's dependent because of his reticence in showing what he knows or revealing what he knows or even knowing it. He becomes a loner, he becomes an outcast and eventually becomes a vagrant, dependent on the kindness of strangers.
Yes.
And the final kindness is a kind of transcendence.
It is. He goes to another place and it's got something to do with the child who is foreseen.
Yes, by Della.
By Della, who is one of his encounters along the way, who is an interesting character as well. She's a gypsy and she has got a degree of second sight, although she's also a naughty minx as well. So she foresees the child. She doesn't really understand the relationship between Eli and the child. But there's also the grandmother, who is the first person who recognises the gift he's got and who is kicked out of the house by Eli's father, because he feels that she is in part to blame for them being ostracised.
Yes.
Because of her grandson's gift. So there's a strange coming together, and I really wrote that in a kind of trance, actually. I don't really know what I was doing.
That's interesting, and I think it's read in a kind of trance. I read it in a kind of trance.
I'm glad.
It took me to another place.
Yes.
It did feel quite transcendent. At moments, light pierces through the story, as when Eli stands in the sea and looks upwards and he's aware of the light behind the darkness.
Yes.
And I think that's very much in the kind of register of this story, really.
Very much. That was an important scene when he walks into the sea and sees the light behind the darkness. I think it's also interesting at that point he remembers a poem by Matthew Arnold, because I think there's this sense in which the gift has denied him of his other potential gifts.
Yes.
I mean, he's clearly an intelligent child.
Yeah. And a sensitive one.
Very sensitive. And he's obviously responded to poetry and to beauty.
Mm.
But he can make nothing of this because of this prophetic gift.
Yeah.
And I suppose, in a way, he's a bit like the prophets in the Old Testament, although I didn't, I mean, I'm just, this is just occurring to me now, that, you know, they are never welcome.
Yes, they're never welcome.
And I think that this whole, I think it's, I do often write about the transcendent, and often in my books there is an element of the transcendent, and there's often an element of, people call it the spiritual, I call it the metaphysical, because I prefer that term. But I think in the short stories it's more obviously the ghost element is stronger.
Yes.
The sense of being haunted is stronger. There is a great tradition in English short story writing of ghost stories.
Yes.
And my father was very fond of M.R. James, for example, and I grew up on those stories. And I'm absolutely sure that has a part to play in my tendency to bring something ghostly and haunting into the short stories, like the churchyard like The Boy Who Could See Death, and there are others. I think also A Christmas Gift, which has a sort of, is the man she meets real or not?
Yes.
We never quite know.
Yes. And you've been called a writer in the great English tradition of moral seriousness by a critic. Do your short stories convey morals as such?
I don't think when he wrote that he meant moral in quite the sense of morality. I think he meant that I explore issues of right and wrong and the complexity of right and wrong.
Yes.
So I think, yes, certainly. I think there's certainly issues of what it means to act decently towards other people,
yes,
what it means to act decently within what relationship, what it means to avoid knowing the truth about oneself, which I think is a very serious moral question.
Yes.
I would probably call it psychological rather than moral, but I think that's what he meant. If you read the whole of the piece,
yes,
it comes from,
okay,
he's really talking about, he's not suggesting I have a moral prescription. He's suggesting that I'm interested in...
No, I think it's the gravity that he's talking about, the
yeah,
seriousness, though.
Yes.
There's a playfulness in many of these stories.
I hope so.
And experimentation, as you said.
I
but there's
so.
Also that serious purpose of looking at relationships, at veracity between people.
I think veracity particularly, and I think maybe especially veracity with oneself.
Yes.
I think the tendency to deceive ourselves and to have pictures of ourselves, as well as pictures of other people, and pictures of how we are towards other people, is something I'm very interested in.
Yes.
Because generally, the picture we have of ourselves is not actually how we affect other people.
No.
They will see us differently. We will see ourselves in a particular light, often a rather comfortable light, and we will look very differently to other people. And I think that whole area of self-knowledge, enlightenment,
yes,
illumination, which I very often embed in a landscape of light and dark,
yes,
is something I do. Yes, I think I do explore it in the short stories. I mean, Moongrass and Vacation are both quite savage moral,
yes,
stories, I think.
Yes, they are. Very revelatory, but also ruthless.
Yes, I think in both Vacation and Moongrass, there's a ruthlessness acquired by the two women in the story. There's an inherent ruthlessness in the mother, but Beth acquires it.
Yes.
She learns it from the mother, and I think that's the scary thing.
Yes. And in Moongrass?
I think in Moongrass, it's learnt from her mistreatment.
Yes.
She isn't naturally ruthless.
Yes.
She learns to be ruthless to preserve herself, and that too is something I learnt in psychoanalysis. You know, sometimes people have to be encouraged to be more ruthless. Often they're not ruthless enough because they can't bring themselves to stand up to people. They're fearful of hurting them. They're fearful of belittling them. They're fearful of humiliating. Very often it's compassion, I think, that's a person's enemy. So it's a balance, as with everything else. And I think different stories have allowed me to experiment with different degrees of self-knowledge, self-care, ruthlessness, compassion towards others.
And that palette of light and dark, really, it's a palette, isn't it? It's not just light and dark, it's all the shades in between.
I would hope so, yes.
Yes.
Yes, no, I would hope so very much. And I think I'm very interested in those moments when, you know, dark can suddenly turn into light.
Yes.
And vice versa.
And vice versa.
I mean, as in The Rescue, where a lifetime of a marriage is suddenly turned on a sixpence, becomes something very different.
And I like the word you used, landscape, because I think your introduction mentions your preoccupation with place as a stimulus for story, but also the way certain places have become part of your inner landscape. So I think really what I'd like to ask is, could you say a bit more about your relationship between inner and outer landscapes as a writer? How does the outer landscape affect your inner world? How do landscapes affect your characters?
Indubitably, I think, write about a landscape, by which I would include a city like Venice or a cathedral like Chartres. I'm speaking about my novels here, but I think I never write about any particular place that appears in either the novels or the stories unless I know it very well.
Mm.
I don't go somewhere in order to write about it. I never do that. So I have to have been there, often repeatedly, in order to write comfortably within it. because by that time that particular landscape or building or city will have infused my inner world, and it will become part of my own system of memories and also my emotional history, because certain things will have happened at certain periods of my life within that landscape.
Yes.
Often at very different points in my life. I mean, very often these are landscapes I first encountered as a child, and then as a girl growing up, and then as a young adult, and subsequently. Very often there will be landscapes that are familiar to me, and then I have, for some reason or other, returned to, and at that point something will happen that makes me think, this is the place for this story. So the two things come together. I will know the landscape, I will revisit the landscape, not to write a story, but just because I'm revisiting the landscape that I like and is important to me. And then something will happen. I will see something, I will hear something, a character will appear in my mind, and it is as though the two things dovetail in my mind, to use Keats's wonderful expression, and that is what creates the story. So it's an alchemy, really, I think.
Yes.
And then having done that, the landscape will inevitably become important to the character, either because they already know it very well, like me, more often because they don't. And so there's an interesting thing in which I, the author, know the landscape, the character doesn't know the landscape.
Yes.
And that's interesting, because then I rediscover the landscape.
Yes. There's an element of defamiliarisation as you rediscover it through your character's consciousness.
And I think that's also a very enjoyable aspect of writing that is perhaps hard to see from the outside until you actually, you know, it's obvious to a writer but not so much to a reader. That part of what's happening is you are yourself discovering, you're discovering a great deal about this character who you didn't know before.
Mm.
This is a big new relationship. You are evolving. And they are evolving, and they are having an effect on you. And the landscape, or environment in which they are moving and have their being, also becomes something that, as you say, you defamiliarise, you are defamiliarised, and you rediscover. It's a very enlightening experience. Yeah. And very often, you see, I will go back and, well, I'll always go back and do the research, even though I know the place very well, because you know, I obviously don't want to get a letter saying, dear Miss Vickers, oh dear Miss Vickers. You know, it isn't the west door, it's the north door. So I will go back, because my memory will not necessarily be right, my notes won't necessarily be right. But in the process of going back, I will see things differently from the way I thought I saw them.
Yes, so memory and the new experience have to create some kind of relationship.
Yeah, and I think memory, I mean, I suppose memory is... Everyone's interested in memory. I'm very interested in memory. And, of course, my work as an analyst is all about memory.
It's all about memory. Retrieving memory and rewriting memory sometimes.
Rewriting memory, retrieving memory. I mean, what is memory? It's a fiction, really.
Mm, it is.
But it's a fiction that we rewrite and recreate, and with luck, it becomes a better fiction.
Yes. That's a fantastic note to end on. Thank you so much for all your insight into your work and into the creation of characters and worlds, and also into the short story form, which I think you enjoy so much that you give such a gift to the reader of new experiences that are also familiar. So thank you.
Well, thank you for reading it so well. Writers love to be read well.